episode 65, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Mike Daskal, Director of Quantum Product Management at the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. The team discuss the quantum development roadmap, quantum hype, and the movement of developments from quantum architecture back to hybrid approaches. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how are you doing today?
Hey, Patrick, I'm doing well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
Yes, and as usual, you won't be disappointed. We're joined by Mike. Mike, do you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
I'm Mike Daskal. I'm Director of Quantum Product Management at the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology.
Wow.
I'm the product lead in a quantum research team under the Fidelity Investment brand that is looking at how quantum will impact our firm and our customers.
Wow. So I really didn't know that Fidelity had such a program, but I think it's amazing because you're looking for what disruptions are going to be caused and you're trying to stay ahead of that, right? Is that the goal, or are you actually doing product development and incubator kind of stuff?
Yes. we're the mandate that we have is quite wide and really nicely so, right? The way that we see it, this technology has opportunity for tremendous impact the next few years and beyond, perhaps a little bit more beyond if we're going to think about timelines. And we really do our work to make sure that when the time comes right, that Fidelity maintains its market leadership and that our customers are really all going to benefit as soon as possible from this and other technologies involved.
That's amazing. I just didn't know that Fidelity and other organizations were thinking that far ahead, but it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. So what are your interests and challenges right now, the things that are grabbing your attention and time right now that you can talk about?
Yeah, of course. It's a good question. You know, there is a lot of uncertainty about what quantum will and won't do and when it will and won't do it. Was that grammatical?
In quantum, everything's grammatical.
And, the uncertainty comes in a few different forms or from a few different sources. On the one hand, there's just genuine academic uncertainty, right? There is a tremendous amount of phenomenal work happening in both industry and academia trying to figure out what algorithms we can create that will prove advantageous to run on quantum systems. On the other side of this, the other difficulty is getting a good, clear picture on what the development roadmap is. And by that, I'm thinking a lot about what's on the mind of many people in the industry, which is the hype that we're seeing surrounding a lot mm-hmm. of quantum computing advances. When you ask about challenges, I think it really is across the board. But of course, that's what makes our jobs interesting.
Right.
So this is one of the things that we've discussed with Patrick like a lot. And I'd like to learn a little bit, like, what is your formula, Mike, of discerning hype from things that really matter, right? Because and we've seen a lot of even public positions in the past 12 months about how quantum is overhyped, and we all know like the great real work that is happening. So I'm curious, like, what is your formula of identifying what's hype and what's stuff that makes sense and that's like reasonable to think about and act upon?
Yeah, no, that's a good question too. We're a really hands-on team, right? So one of the ways that we really actively avoid falling into hype, I don't know what
traps.
To call them. I don't. Yeah,
traps.
Is just getting our hands dirty. We do a lot of work testing and benchmarking theoretically and through simulations and through real machines. Those advances which we think might have something behind them.
The disruptors.
We also, I think that our work isn't just a matter of testing and benchmarking. We do algorithm development. So we've got a couple papers out that describe some work that we've done in collaboration with a few other companies. And so, we're not just sitting on the sidelines looking at what the research is saying and what the headlines are saying, which are often two very different things, and then testing things down. Then we're deep in the weeds here.
Cool.
Trying to advance the science.
So there's two different sides to this that I find. There's the encryption is about to break. The military industrial complex cares about that. And there's money pouring in because of that. And there's the, this is going to like save the planet in, you know, material science and carbon capture and, you know, the Haber process. So do you have a side that you typically pay attention to and one that you can ignore, or are both of those germane in your work?
So I think both are germane, but not equally hypey, if you will. So, I mean, I didn't want to call it any names, but you mentioned almost word for word some of the headlines we've seen, that I think are really kind of dangerous to our ecosystem. And that's more on the computing side. On the security side, there is unquestionably a threat there, right? Like we've known since 94 that we will be able to use these systems when they're available to break all the encryption, all the asymmetric encryption standards that we're using today.
Correct.
And I know that you can correct me. You're probably more of an expert on that than I am. But the fear there, I think, isn't just limited to when are these machines going to be available, because there is this threat that's often called harvest now, decrypt later, where people are just collecting encrypted data because it's cheap to store things now, much cheaper than it was in the past. And they're going to hold on to it until they can use these systems. And that's a threat that we need to deal with now. So in FCAT, we're looking really at both sides of this. We have work going on in the quantum computing research, as well as work in post-quantum security and how to mitigate that threat as soon as possible, and then more so moving forward as these machines come, say, closer to becoming available.
Now you also do incubators. So you're taking organizations that are trying to do something, you know, in this space, and I assume they're not building quantum computers. They're more of on top of the algorithm side of things, or am I wrong? Are you doing hardware in the incubators?
Oh, I see what you mean. So maybe you've seen the term incubator in our communications. We call our research team an incubator, and so far as we're researching
But you pay attention probably to the other, because quantum is emerging as, I mean, right now there's three hot areas, in my opinion. There's cyber, which has really caught on fire. I've been in it for over 20 years, and I can attest that it's getting way more attention than it ever got before. There's quantum, which the promise is incredibly rich. And then there's AI. And so we're still early on in the quantum, but we're not early on in that it's going to take a long time to get there. Are you concerned about the education component of that, getting people to understand this so we have enough workers in the sector? What's keeping you up at night?
That's a very good point, actually. It's funny you ask. There was really just a couple weeks ago a new report by McKinsey that came out on the ecosystem, and this followed a report from last year where they focused especially strongly on the skill gap, right? So last year, I think it was in May or June, the report said that there were roughly three times as many jobs as there were applicants with the necessary skills, right? The number has gotten a bit better. That's to say the gap is closing, but it's still really significant. And I think it is something that we need to be thinking about in the ecosystem. Part of the problem here, of course, is that there's a demand for a certain level of skill that's unsustainable, right? If you think back to classical computing and how it developed, I like to think of it, I kind of call it the Grace Hopper moment, where Grace Hopper came in, she developed compilers that changed the way that we interacted with these devices. And what it meant is that there was suddenly a new door open to engaging with computing in a way that allowed for just
mere
advances
mortals
that would be otherwise impossible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we traded some of the initial advances in computing power were traded away to make it easier for lack of a better word, for lower level ability skill groups to be able to engage. Instead of having to program in binary, you got to program in assembly and then languages that were in English languages. We're not there yet in quantum because we're still we don't have a surplus of technology that we can waste, making it easier for the silly humans to be able to keep up.
And I think we aren't even really sure what we would be able to do with it, right? I think part of the problem too is that we're still building these fundamental algorithms, and it's uncertain what will be good and what won't be good on quantum.
Well, Cyprian asked a question in one of our shows maybe 7-8 months ago, maybe it was even a year ago, of are there going to be more of these big algorithms? I mean, I'm a security guy, so Shor is one that I pay a lot of attention to. Cyprian's a big data guy, AI guy, so he pays attention to Grover's. Are there that many problems that are NP hard that we can actually say, yeah, there we go, we're going to do it, we're going to solve this with quantum? Or do we already see the landscape and we just don't know that we are already at the edges? You're doing research in this area. Are you seeing promising new algorithms that are trying to tackle problems that computers will never solve?
So I can't, I think that there's, sorry, there are a few things there that I want to pick up on.
Okay. Sorry if I'm asking them.
No. It's a great question. I think that there are a few things to consider here. So in terms of, are there other problems that are intractable that quantum will help with? I think almost certainly so. You did mention NP hardness there. And I think that one of the tricky bits is that it's probably easy to find NP hard problems, but quantum is going to help out not at the hardness, not at NP hard level, but at the NP level below that, if anywhere, right? That's where Shor lies.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of questions there. It's just probably one of the reasons that I'm hesitating on some of my words. But I think that there are likely going to be cases where we find some kind of advantage on quantum systems I expect there are going to be cases on quantum systems where we find advantage that may not be linked to a particular theoretical speed up in the way that we've seen with Shor and Grover. I think the other thing is that, you know, there were a number of algorithms that were kind of potentially helpful here, and this is really important. Then there was a let's call it a discovery that we could do a lot of this classically efficiently, right?
Yeah.
And so as we're building up our potential quantum algorithm tool belt, it's really possible that some of this stuff is going to keep getting kind of snipped off.
It's competition.
That means that
it's healthy competition.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
When we think about what quantum computers will be able to do versus classical, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that classical computers are still developing, right? They're still getting much better.
That's true.
We've seen this just in the past couple of years with GPUs, for example, and their development and the way that they've enabled AI in ways that were never before possible. And so, you know, I would very much not want to give an answer to, will there be another Shor? I don't know. But I think there will be spaces, and I say that specifically because we might end up finding something and then the next generation of computing architectures just will blow it out of the water. But I do expect that there are going to be cases where quantum will prove advantageous, even if it's just as, you know, as a little step in
shortcuts.
Some other algorithm. Yeah.
I mean, like Shor is a shortcut.
There's a different thing that is going on, which is the hybrid scenarios, right? Shor itself, I think it's the perfect example of a hybrid approach. Because, right, Shor in quantum doesn't solve factorization, right? It solves a sub-problem, and the rest of it still needs to be solved by classical. And I think that, and I've seen a lot of work from the likes of IBM and Microsoft and the others on closing the gap between running classical code and quantum code. And I believe this will also open a very interesting range of algorithms where you don't need to think in like terms of it's pure quantum, it's pure classical. The combination of those and being able to move back and forth between these two worlds, I think yields a lot of potential, right? Hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what we're going to start seeing more. Actually, we already are seeing more and more of this insofar as, right, you've got platforms that are coming out specifically designed for hybrid computing, and not in the sense of NISC-friendly variational algorithm stuff, but actual future-looking hybrid computational applications that are going to start making some of this more and more viable or achievable.
Yeah, because, and back to what Patrick mentioned that I said, right? My concern is that we're not yet very good at understanding where can we use quantum efficiently, right? We know like the top level use cases. We know like, oh, it's good for optimization. Oh, it's good for material science. Could be good for machine learning and AI. We don't know that yet. That's why I think that work, as you mentioned, your team is doing, Mike, is essential in terms of people getting their hands dirty and trying to understand beyond that principle level, like, oh, can we really have some real lift here? That's if you ask me, that's my main concern in terms of what is the future for the next decade in quantum.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I was recently at a conference where I heard somebody say this. I really quite liked. They said, look, if you're talking to somebody who says that they can provide advantage with NISQ systems now, you should go talk to somebody else. it's the honesty that we all need, right? I think even, you know, Cyprian, you just mentioned that I would even hesitate to say that we know that quantum is going to be good for optimization. I think that these are still live questions. Right. And while there's good reason to think that these are going to be cases where quantum will be applied with advantage, there's a lot left unknown there. That's not to say that, I mean, this is where we should all be doing our research. We should be trying to figure out these problems that are going to be good and comparing it to where we expect classical is going to go to make sure that advantage remains. But yeah, I mean, this is my default pushing back on anything that I think is remotely hypey, right?
So it's interesting. One of my former mentors, who's now retired, used to say, most people are so happy to have a solution to a problem at hand, they never look for an alternative. And what I notice is that quantum is forcing us to rethink problems of optimization and other things in new ways that may be more beneficial, even if they're not using quantum computing. So, for example, when I first started hearing about quantum, I saw a session by One Qubit up in Vancouver. And they were talking about the fact that they saw an 8% increase in efficiency on average for most processes they did by rethinking them as quantum processes. Now, that was at a time when they were simulating a quantum computer and there was no quantum at all. It was just them thinking about it in a new way and casting it in a new way. And so there's advantage, and not this classical quantum advantage, but there's advantage in just taking a problem and forcing people to rethink about it in a new cast, because you get new ideas, you get another angle. If there's five solutions to a problem, what's the odds that the one you found first is the best? Well, it's one in five. Yeah. And so it's kind of forcing us out of our comfort zone in spite of what you just said, which is it may not actually be the best way.
Yeah, no, actually we've seen that. We had a problem come in and we looked at it, developed a quantum algorithm and said, hold on a second, do we really need to run this on a quantum computer? Turned out it wasn't a great idea. The algorithm was great, but it just didn't need that.
But it was worth the look.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it led to a new solution that we didn't have before. And that is intrinsically valuable, right?
Right.
So one of the things that I've been wondering as we were progressing with our discussion is how do you convince a big organization, right? To do like a financial organization like your case, right? To do actual research work in quantum. What is like, let's say, what is the core idea that your team started with? What is your, let's say, vision and mission statement in terms of how do you think you can help your organization with the work that you do? And I think that it's very important for our listeners to understand, like, We start to see these real world cases where large organizations, right, are starting to take the stuff very, very seriously. Could it be out in the next 5 years? We don't know. In the next 10 years, we still don't know, right? But the fact that there are organizations investing in quantum, right, actively, I think speaks volumes.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good question as to not only how do you convince an organization to do so, but how do you know when it is time to do so, right?
Right.
Our work came out of early experimentation and research that is just the type of thing that is in FCAT's blood. Like, that's just the type of research that we do. And as we looked into it further, we thought, no, this is worth diving deeper into. We should see exactly what these machines will be capable of, what they won't be capable of, when we need to start mitigating threats they're going to pose, and get a better idea of what this timeline does look like, even given, you know, the various levels of uncertainty there are. I think that it really probably does depend on one, you know, from one organization to another, but we see our mission as trying to figure out when we should use this device.
Yeah.
And that should, as compared to say a can, it's not about when we can use it, it's when we should use it, is fundamentally, I think, the type of question that should be posed by any organization that has a capacity to do so. Especially when you have a technology that promises a significant disruption, even if it is just in the cybersecurity space, right? Mm. So I certainly wouldn't have any kind of good advice as to how do you convince an organization to do this beyond that. I think that it's, yeah, sorry, go on.
I think the skills gap is actually evidence of the fact that you can't wait to the last minute on this. This is definitely the kind of thing that makes your head hurt in order to wrap your head around it. I find that it's almost like allergy exposure therapy, where I know a lot of really smart people who have told me, I'm never going to understand this stuff because they tried to get into it too quickly. You got to almost like work your way into the pool to really understand the nuances of it and everything and let it all get into the nooks and crannies. And I think that's why we're having the skills gap thing. If, you know, when HTML was new, and they were paying $100 for people who could do handwrite HTML. If you wanted to spend an afternoon learning HTML, you did, and then you were one of those resources. That's why the price came down so quickly. I don't see quantum in the same light. It requires you to first confront the fact that the universe isn't anything like what we expected it to be. And that alone sometimes takes 6 months to a year to, you know, get in. We need support groups.
That was my PhD. I mean, that was...
we need support groups for people who have just started learning quantum computing to, like, you know, blows their mind. So I think it's important, especially with this technology, that organizations think about it early and often, because it's not going to be clearly evident what is and isn't going to work as it is with other technologies. Big data, for example, to pick on Cyprian's, you know, one of his big areas. It was very obvious where you could use big data in companies to do disruption. I don't see that obviousness yet in the quantum side, maybe because it's too early, but I think it's also because it's kind of a murky surface. It's not instantly obvious where it's going to disrupt. And that makes it scarier and more exciting, I think, too.
No, I think that's right. I do like that way to think about it. It is what makes it scary and also exciting.
Exactly.
I wonder if there's... So when I think back to kind of the ways that certain deep tech industries have developed, there have... I don't know. I think that there have been... I could be wrong. Have been some surprises that creep up on us. So, you know, the past 6 months, everyone has been looking deeply into LLMs and generative AI in ways that didn't happen quite so much a year prior. And I do wonder if, while that is very popular now and there are many more people looking at it now than ever before, there is still very much a murkiness and scariness and uncertainty about what that's going to do. And part of me thinks, can we learn from this, right? Mm-hmm. Can we do something better so that with quantum, we're a little bit more prepared in every way, right? As companies, as individuals, as a society, to keep ourselves protected and making sure that we benefit from these things in productive and ethical manners.
Well, we have the benefit of seeing the classical computing evolution and the mistakes and the pitfalls. For example, right now, Microsoft is already building middleware so that you can run any quantum system hardware and use the same language on the top. That didn't happen until decades after computing had already hit its kind of its stride. And now we're getting that work being done ahead of time. So we have the luxury of it, of this being our second go around in inventing a whole new computing space. I'm excited for what the third will be, but I probably won't live to see it. Maybe it's biological computers or who knows. I dare not guess.
On a different note, what I wanted to ask you is, How do you see the space of talent in quantum research? And I know you mentioned that study that showed that like there's a gap, right? But I would like to kind of take this from a different angle. I really love to see what is the experience of folks of dealing with the resources who are, let's say, not quantum born, meaning classic computer scientists, right, reinvented in the quantum world, versus what I call the quantum born generation, which is we're starting to see that emerging, who are folks who are directly exposed to quantum only. Have you had the chance to work with these types of people? Because, like, from my point of view, Mike, I think the big breakthroughs are necessarily going to come from this generation. All of us who have lived long enough in classical quantum computing, I don't think we will be able to move things forward. I think we need this generation, what I call them quantum born, right, who are like literally going to move things forward. I would like to see a little bit, what is your experience of working with different types of human resources in this field?
I think you're right. I think that this, I like quantum born. I sometimes think of it as quantum native, which is basically
quantum
the same
native
thing. I think this is true, and I think this is another thing we've seen before, right? I think that the ability to adopt and engage deeply with new technologies is just much easier for, you know, as the generations have gone. With people who grow up with computers have a much easier time dealing with computers than those who haven't. There's a deeper question here that I'm going to kind of pivot to, because we've been talking about learning from the past and what the workforce looks like in a sense, right? And I think that there is still more to do here to both learn from the past and make sure that we do get that maximal benefit from the quantum-born generation. And here, I'm trying to think about how I can frame this in the right way. In the same way that coming from a fully kind of classical information theoretic viewpoint of computer science will limit the scope of things that you look at when you get to quantum, I think that there is a parallel limitation with what we can get at if we don't make sure that we're building this ecosystem in a healthy way that embraces kind of all the voices and all the viewpoints and all the mindsets that can come with it.
Diversity.
It's a totally new technology, and you've just anticipated what I was going to say, right? I think making sure that we have a properly diversified workforce is incredibly important, because it's through the diversification of ideas and the collaboration across not just individuals, but academic institutions, industry institutions, the freelance worker, that we're going to really be able to speed up the progress to fill in these gaps and these question marks about what quantum's good for. And now I'm going to take my moment to plug my non-Fidelity work. So outside of Fidelity, I have just opened, in collaboration with Denise Ruffner, who's run Women in Quantum for years, we've opened a nonprofit called Diversity in Quantum, where we're really aiming to help raise the voices, help give those who are coming from underrepresented groups in the STEM field the chance to come up and start their careers in the quantum ecosystem. And we really believe that this is both mutually beneficial for these individuals and for the ecosystem as a whole, but also that this is the time to do it, right? Like, we're just talking about learning from AI and some of the failures there. This is the type of thing that we can build from the ground up. We have a new ecosystem that we can make sure is properly diversified at the start. And I think this has a potential to make a big difference in the timeline for how this technology evolves.
And there's better tools available. I agree with you on the timing, that there's tools available now. It's not as Wild West as it used to be. There's a lot more resources, free resources. And really, to some extent, what you have to do is just make people aware of them. And you can lead the fish, you know, not lead the fish, not give them a fish, but but lead the horse to the water and it might drink the whole river. You know, are there tools specifically that you're trying to put them onto? Or are you custom developing learning tools? Are you using Nawson's book, our mutual friend? What are you kind of doing for like getting them jump-started?
Well, I think, and this, you know, getting back to the skills gap question, I think the problem is often here a matter of, what's the word I'm looking for? So I think fundamentally the issue here is not so much picking the right tools and making sure the right resources are available, because there are a lot of great resources out there, many free, you know, that's there. Mm-hmm. But there is still fundamentally a problem of the pipeline not being that diversified because of the high demands for education levels that are required to get into the ecosystem. And there are a lot of reasons that the pipeline itself isn't too diverse. Mm-hmm. So our main strategy here is not so much to be another instrument by which people can come and get the resources to learn things that are already out there, but rather to be an organization that helps create role models, provide mentorships, make it clear to people from underrepresented groups that they can do this if they want. Mm-hmm. And this is all to help support them along the way. And yes, we will kind of point them to resources out there, but we don't want to build those from scratch. But there are phenomenal free textbooks. There are free courses you can sign up for. And we're happy to kind of help support those. But it's more about making these groups feel that they do belong in this space, because I think that's what's been lacking. And that's really something that has been, to the best of many efforts, not properly dealt with over the years.
I mean, this whole podcast is about that.
And I think that one area where hype has done a lot of damage, I believe, is I think it kind of created this perception that unless you hold three PhDs simultaneously in physics, mathematics, and material science, right, quantum is not for you. I think it's one type of misinformation, at least here at Entangle Things, that we're trying to fight. Like,
exactly.
The entry level barrier is high, but it's not as high as the hype is suggesting these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. And furthermore, I mean, a higher entry barrier should not be the reason that somebody doesn't join, right? That if somebody can do something and they want to do it, they should be able to do it.
Yeah.
And we want to try to make that easier and better.
Yeah. We're all about, as I was saying, we're all about, this is why we do the podcast, is education. It's not my core business. It's not Cyprian's core business. You know, we're definitely getting deeper into it and experiencing it better. I tell you, the best way, you know what you should do? Have all these kids start a podcast. They'll learn a ton. Cause that's a great way to learn. But I think it's that slow and steady approach. If you help people understand that if they get confused by this double slit experiment, they shouldn't walk away. They should give themselves a week and then approach it again with new eyes. And that's really the key, is anybody can understand this stuff and everyone should understand this stuff. We had a guest that talked about teaching this to high schoolers in Brooklyn. And it'll eventually become like, oh yeah, that's okay. I didn't know how the world worked. Now I do. The problem is a lot of us thought we understood how the world worked. And then we were disabused of that quite rudely by the universe, which has been a little bit interesting.
I think that there's also, I mean, this is not so much an issue of diversity, but it's more of an issue of education and how one learns this stuff. I remember I was in a professor's seminar once, and he gave great advice when it came to learning something new, especially when it's kind of formal or mathematical. He said, look, here's what you do. You go to the library, you take three books on the topic out at random. It has to be, it's importantly, just three of the books that you see there. You then read them in a random order. And again, it's important that it's random here. So arbitrarily pick the first one, read it, then the second one, read it, and the third. He said, you will even inevitably come to the following conclusion. After the first one, it won't make any sense. After the second one, it'll start to make a little bit of sense. The third one will be incredibly clear, and you'll wonder why nobody else did it that way to begin with. And he's right, right? Like, this is... The thing about learning this stuff is you just have to go through it, you have to be ready to fail. And you have to know that failure doesn't mean that it's not for you. And I think right. that's a really hard thing for many people to kind of internalize.
Yeah. We're just too stubborn. Is that it? Those that have made it through, we're just too stubborn. So we're coming up on about 35 minutes. We still got time for a little bit more discussion. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up or talk about or highlight before we wrap up this great conversation?
I do feel like there's been a little bit of back and forth, and we've at moments sounded very optimistic and at moments sounded very pessimistic. And I think it'd be good. I'm curious to hear from you. I mean, well, let me start to say, I take myself to be optimistic about the capabilities and the future of quantum, but cautiously so and realistically so, right? I think that we're talking at least more than a few years for some initial first advantageous cases. And then probably over a decade before we start seeing anything remotely like fault tolerance, and then probably a few more generations of that before we get to really being able to run Grover. This is a personal opinion. Mm-hmm. I don't see this as pessimistic, although some might say it is. I'm curious, is that kind of how you see things and how others have expressed it on the podcast?
Cyprian, what do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. I am optimistic in a sense that for me the limitations of classical computing are very, very clear, right? And even if we kind of pave the surface of planet Earth with data centers and with GPUs and whatever, right, there will be a lot of problems that we will not be able to solve. And some of those problems, I believe, are crucial for the long-term survival of our species, right? Including here material science and things mm-hmm. like that. So it has to be something. I really hope it's quantum computing, but if it's not, then has to be something else. We need to take this forward leap in our computing capabilities. And just to come back to what I started with, I am optimistic about quantum computing. I think quantum computing has a lot of potential. We might discuss in 10 years from now about the completely different quantum computing that we are discussing now, right? That's a possibility. But I think there is potential. And seeing the big players, private sector, government, academia being involved heavily in this, right, gives me reason to be optimistic.
My perspective is that this is the prelude that gets us to the good stuff. So we're still trying to figure out whether it's going to, you know, when it's going to impact encryption and when its optimization is going to be, you know, clearly improved by it, and whether a simulation. I think simulation in the chemical area for material science is really where we're going to see changes. We're still in the beginning of the beginning of quantum, probably. But when I look at, I like sci-fi, Dune and all the other shows. When there's no magic, when it's strictly sci-fi, the difference between us and the more advanced humans is material science. Better ways to store energy, better ways to generate energy, better ways to, you know, harness and defend. And so we're really only a few thousand material discoveries away from a brighter future. And I think quantum's really going to be ushering that in. I was a chemistry major for a couple of years before I swapped in school. And chemistry really hasn't benefited from the computing revolution the way other sciences have. But quantum could deliver that. But I think we need to wrestle out of the beginning and into the end of the beginning or the middle before that's going to be the case. And so for me, it's all worth it.
And I really like that.
What I always like to ask people is, imagine taking the builders of ENIAC and showing them a GPU, right?
Yeah.
What would be the reaction, right? The principle is the same. Right? The principle is the same, right? Imagine what would be the reaction. I think this is what will happen in quantum computing in some way or the other.
Yeah. Oh, you got to be careful, though. They might rage quit and say, I'm done. I'm not going to. All right. Well, we're coming up to our time. Anything else you'd like to part us with, Mike? It has been a great discussion.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Nothing else on my end. See you next time, Cyprian. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. It's been great. Bye.